Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, John Karsibayev.
My name is Ron Rickey. I'm CEO and founder of Aduro Advisors, and thanks so much for having me.
Ron, thanks so much for making time to join me on the Ivy Podcast. We've been trying for quite some time to make this happen, so I'm glad to finally, you know, being able to connect with you on a lot of things that's been going on in the industry and with Aduro Advisors and, you know, just overall venture capital space is super exciting. So, but before we get into all of that, give us a thumbnail version of your career to date.
Yeah. So I started in venture back in 99 have been, you know, in the industry for a long time, obviously. Always on the back office, kind of CFO, financial side of things. But prior to starting Aduro Advisors, was the founding CFO of True Ventures, where, you know, really I kind of, you know, learned a lot in terms of, you know, building a firm from the ground up, which I think I've been able to, you know, really kind of continue and take that knowledge and, you know, work with all the emerging managers that are coming into the marketplace today.
That's super exciting. And taking that experience, I would imagine that kind of led you saw a need in the market, you saw a need for a particular problem, so to say, which led you to form Aduro Advisors. Tell us a little bit more about that. What problem are you guys solving and what are you looking to accomplish next?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, one of the reasons that I, you know, took the risk to join True Ventures really out of its infancy was really kind of, and you know, saw the shift in the venture marketplace. From, you know, what it was from a classic standpoint to kind of really building out the next generation platform VCs, as I like to refer to them. So like First Round, True, Union Square, et cetera. You know, so kind of all the groups in that class. And the reason I say that is because, you know, fast forward 6.5 years after you know, founding True or helping to get that going, really started to recognize that there was a new shift happening in venture, which was this complete bifurcation of the marketplace where, you know, individuals or, you know, two GPs can come together and really more easily create a firm of their own. And really recognize that there would be a lot of value in creating a firm that was, you know, somewhat dedicated to supporting that component of the market. And, you know, obviously that piece of the market has grown exponentially larger than I'd ever anticipated. But, you know, so I won't take full credit for having complete foresight as to, you know, where we are today with just the sheer number and the sheer volume that's happening there. But that was really what I was, you know, originally setting out to be able to solve.
So being in the industry since 99, I believe you said you've seen the overall industry go through different iterations, different cycles in all kinds of different directions. And I would imagine current times is no different from of where the state of venture capital is just in general.
Right.
Share your thoughts on that. How's that different? And just overall curious to get your insights into some of the trends that you're trying to stay on top of these days. And where do you see, at least from your personal crystal ball, where this is going?
Having started in the industry in 99 was really an interesting time of it, of course, you know, given just the, you know, what happened in the early 2000s. And also through that, you know, 2005 timeframe of it ticking back up. And then of course, the, you know, the 08, 09 timeframe and, you know, really kind of seeing how much opportunity really kind of comes into play during those, you know, times of turmoil, if you will. Granted, today is very different. There's so much more capital flowing into to our little piece of the overall, you know, global market or overall economy. And I really think that that's driving a lot of the difference, if you will, in terms of the you know, the long lasting nature of the trend that we're seeing within this market. Because I think that, you know, there are a great deal more investors who are, you know, knowledgeable about the venture space, and especially about early and seed stage than even 10 years ago, and a lot more people interested in being a part of that, investing in it. And so I think that there's just a lot more capital available in general for our piece of the market across the board. In terms of where we're seeing things, I mean, you know, this is going to be nothing new. It's all of the things that we hear a lot about in the news, you know, anything from crypto to, you know, tokenization to NFTs, et cetera. You know, we've been working with groups in and around that space for quite some time, and it's becoming much more mainstream now. So, you know, we hear a lot more about it with, you know, a larger population of our clients versus, you know, just a select few. And, you know, not that they're specifically focused on it, it's just that they're recognizing there's a component to their strategy that they should have, you know, put into that those pieces of the market, just because there's so much opportunity within that realm.
So aside from the technology and the software of a back office for the funds that you guys provide, you also act as kind of the strategic advisors or the consultants from, you know, from just overall fund formation and manage, you know, relationships with LPs and things like that, reporting. From the first time founder perspective or the emerging kind of fund manager standpoint, what are some of the kind of recurring mistakes or pitfalls that you've been observing for the past couple of years as you partner with, you know, maybe mature funds that are just forming from that standpoint? Just share some thoughts from what your personal observations have been.
Yeah, so I mean, luckily nothing too, you know, significant kind of jumps out, but, you know, in a handful of cases, you know, people who have just tried to do the back office on their own, you know, saving money, you know, ultimately for you know, for really no good purpose. And so it just creates a lot more cleanup for us as when we do come in, you know, whether it be on fund two or what have you. You know, obviously that's self-serving, right? For us as a business, but yeah, I mean, there's a lot that can kind of get messy pretty quickly within, you know, within kind of what we would be responsible for from a back office provider perspective. And you're right. I mean, we really do kind of play uniquely so that more advisory type of role, hence the word advisors in our name. And that's really one of the key components that I wanted to bring to the table when I created Aduro, is not just to be that third party administrator, not just kind of check the box on that side of things, but really be a partner with our clients. And a trusted partner that's working collaboratively with them, you know, throughout their entire life cycle. And so, you know, I really place a lot of value on our abilities to do that and kind of bring our collective experience, not just myself, but, you know, other senior members of our team who come out of industry, and, you know, really kind of apply that to what we're seeing today with, you know, what our managers, our GPs, our clients are dealing with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. That's definitely a very interesting space. Especially for the first time fund managers, I think there's a lot of learning opportunities from that standpoint when it comes to, you know, weighing the balance between the cost savings or the value of the given technology that's, you know, that helps them manage the fund. So I'm pretty sure we can spend the rest of the episode talking about this, but just moving on from that space, in the sense from, as you advise and work with a lot of venture capital firms, whether of different size or different stage we're in, whether that's a fund one or fund five, from a perspective of, and I'm formulating the question in the sense the trends that you see in difference from the funds that are very successful, in the sense being able to build that generational aspect of that. When you go very long term, you play a long term game, you go from fund one through fund 10 almost, versus the ones that, you know, probably end the journey at just not even beyond fund two probably. Sure. I realize it's a loaded question, but from a standpoint of some of the, you know, major commonalities that you observe between those that are very successful and that are not, what are some of the things that you can pinpoint from that perspective?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And definitely see, you know, a lot of correlation between specific things and, you know, those firms that really kind of were successful at raising, you know, time and time again, fund after fund after fund. Yeah, I think one of the biggest ones that kind of pops to mind that really jumps out is really sticking to your strategy. Wavering in your strategy can be good if you're taking advantage of, you know, some short-term, you know, opportunity. And, you know, there's obviously room to tweak your strategy, but really kind of sticking to your core strategy over the long term is something that I see, you know, very valuable for a firm to do, to kind of really build that, you know, multi-fund platform, you know, generational type of fund. You know, much more so than just kind of running after what's hot at that given moment. And like I said, you know, of course there's room to tweak here and there and to do some components. But anytime you shift significantly from that, it's just dangerous. And so that's kind of one of the biggest things that that I've seen across the board for funds that have been extremely successful. And then building out those long-term relationships with their investors, right? And what I mean by that is, basically always be fundraising at the end of the day. You're always cultivating those relationships with potential investors, whether it be for the current fund or two funds down the road. And always be collectively looking at, okay, who should I bring into the mix maybe in this next fund? Even if I am completely oversubscribed, is there somebody that could come and add value even from the investor side, right? And so really looking at that investor composition from not just a monetary perspective, but also strategic perspective as well, and really kind of thinking through who can be ultimately helpful to your strategy, to your portfolio, to what you're really trying to accomplish.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the kind of the investment kind of part of the thesis that I subscribe to is that internal consistency, so to say, it goes hand in hand with what you're talking about, not chasing the next hot thing, but able to design a process that at the end of the day lets you stay consistent, whether that's from an investment perspective or building that relationship with LPs. I think that's a great advice. I think overall it definitely makes perfect sense. So looking at things from the other side of the spectrum, from an LP standpoint, I would imagine maybe you either are an LP in certain funds, or you've been exposed to your great share of LPs out there from just your line of work. What are some of the things that you have observed from a perspective of successful LPs that are capable of identifying unique opportunities in investing very unique spaces within the funds? How do you go about that evaluation, especially when it comes to very unique and specialized funds, maybe even the first time ones? Mm-hmm. What are some of the evaluation criteria that helps some of the successful LPs make better decisions versus those that are just, generalist in nature?
Yeah. And I think kind of taking a step back and kind of recognizing the fact that with this huge explosion of managers, it's actually made an LP's job, tremendously harder, right? Because historically speaking, they were adding, 10, 12 new names to the mix, over a certain amount of time, right? And so now we're asking them effectively, the market is asking them to be willing to add, many, many new names to the mix because of just how bifurcated the market has become with the funds, with these, a specialized fund in each of these various markets. So I think the LPs have probably needed to really take a step back and really craft a strategy, a more detailed strategy, more granular, to look at, okay, these are the areas that we want to invest in. And no longer can we just go to, a big fund that's going to invest in all of those markets. We have to actually break it up and commit to these specialized funds. And I think the willingness to be able to do that is what makes LPs really successful, is the willingness to actually break that up and really do that heavy lifting from a work perspective of saying, okay, if I want fintech, I have to go and invest in, these two names, whatever it is, or in crypto, or in, whatever that, piece of the strategy they want to get exposure to. Mm-hmm. So I think they have to more carefully manage that exposure. But I think at the end of the day, what's really created success on the LP side of the equation is that willingness to be more flexible in how they think about building out their portfolio, right? Things have completely changed, and just, the willingness to be a part of that, I think, is key. And like I said, thankfully, the LP universe has grown exponentially, and so much of that still comes down to relationships, right? So much of the LP money is still high net worth individuals, family offices. And those are one of the toughest areas to really tap into for a manager going out and raising money, because it's all relationship driven at the end of the day. There's not one place to go to, basically go and contact all of these groups and say, hey, I'm raising, here's my information. Mm-hmm. So it's still a difficult marketplace from that standpoint as well.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, at the end of the day, it's a contact sport, and it applies to anything. It applies to venture capital, it applies to sales, marketing, whatever the case may be. Everything is, you know, it's a partner economy. Everything is relationship-based. Mm-hmm. So if you're capable of succeeding in that side of the spectrum, I think everything else becomes relatively straightforward, being able to deliver on kind of the first side of the equation of the relationship. So in this highly competitive market when it comes to talent and talent acquisition, I can't help but ask for you to surround yourself with the top performers, at least for your company, to be able to identify, you know, the top talent and then attract them to join your company. What are some of the strategies that really help you succeed in that space? Just talk to us a little bit from a standpoint of talent acquisition.
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously a difficult conversation for everybody right now, right? Just kind of given the way the market is. And so I think that's absolutely right, is, you know, attracting those top individuals that are going to continue to attract those other top individuals, right? I mean, that's always the key at the end of the day, and not lowering your bar, right? You know, I always tell people that, you know, we have, you know, X number of spots to fill. We could go and fill them tomorrow, but, you know, we really want to fill those seats with those quality individuals. And so, you know, rather than just, you know, being able to check the box and say that those seats are filled, we're going to take our time and we're going to, you know, accept the pain that goes along with that temporarily for the sake of hiring those top quality people, you know, that can continue to attract the top quality people. So I think that just, you know, being focused, again, it's kind of like sticking to your strategy, right? Sticking to the quality of individual that you want to surround yourself with. And that was actually one of the other things that I was going to mention with regards to those successful firms that have kind of built that multi-fund strategy successfully, is they've surrounded themselves with, you know, top quality people in general, and been very careful about how they did that and how they added and who they added. And so I think that there needs to just take a lot of time, or be, you know, to put in a lot of time into how you think you build out that core team.
Right, absolutely. And to take that a little bit further, as we talk about building that culture of retention where the top performers do stay with the companies for many years, they feel challenged, they feel rewarded, they feel like they have plenty of opportunity to grow, they feel valued. It's also challenging for a lot of companies to succeed in that space because of, you know, there's so many opportunities out there for those that, you know, that are top performers. How do you think about that? How do you structure kind of some of the processes or just overall culture of your organization when it comes to retention?
Yeah, you know, if I look at a lot of the top people within my organization, you know, many of them have been, you know, we're a 9-year-old company. And, you know, many of them have been with us for, you know, 5, 6, 7 years. And so I think that that's pretty significant given where, when I started, it was literally just myself, right? So it's not like, you know, they've been with us for a very, very long part of the journey, if you will. And, you know, through a lot of different connotations of what Aduro is, you know, versus what it was. And so, but I think that because of that growth, because of that, you know, constant changing of our company, we've been able to keep them engaged and keep them interested in what they're doing, and really been able to give a lot of people a lot of great opportunities as well. And so, you know, as we're growing as a company, there's of course the natural, you know, pull of, you know, growing the individuals within that as well. And so, you know, just being at a growing organization is obviously, you know, step one, but also creating a culture where they feel supported and they feel they want to be a part of it. And, you know, really, you know, putting a lot of emphasis on that culture, and a culture where, you know, it's not a top-down approach. It's very much a, you know, kind of a, you know, everybody's in this together type of approach. You know, we look to everybody down the chain here at Aduro to offer up ideas, to offer up feedback in terms of how we could do things better, how we could be more efficient, how we could better serve our customers, because they're obviously the ones, you know, at the forefront, doing that on a day in and day out basis. And so we want to hear that. And so we really, really strive to create a culture where, you know, we can get that feedback loop from within.
So you've mentioned feedback loop, and For me, I've been an executive at Fortune 500 large corporations, as well as my own startups. And I've always struggled with that particular aspect of providing feedback, just the overall these performance evaluations. I hated it. So I'm pretty sure all the employees who receive it, they hate it. It's just a dreadful exercise for all across the board. So for me, some of the lessons learned for some of the great leaders that I was fortunate enough to, you know, to work under, some of the greatest advice that I've received is, you know, it usually starts out with some of the kind of the better news. Okay, here's what you did well. And then, but everyone's waiting for that but.
Right.
You know,
Exactly.
It's a dreadful exercise. And as Emily Choi, I've listened to her podcast, the president CEO of Coinbase, she mentioned something within the lines that horses do smell fear from very far away. And it's kind of similar analogy that when you do give that feedback to employees, there's always that fear. There's always that kind of both ways. Just overall, how do you go about kind of these performance evaluations? What's your structure like, and just anything that you can share there?
Yeah. I would point to a couple of our senior team members to better answer this, because they've helped me, you know, really kind of take the lead on creating what this looks like for our organization. And, you know, that kind of comes back to, you know, to my focus on creating a flatter organization, where I know that's not an area of strength, and I want to bring in the best people to help us kind of create that and you know, create a successful outcome there. Because like you said, it can be a very, you know, troubling situation with an employee getting any sort of negative feedback, right? The positive is all great, but that's just that one little piece of negative. They'll focus only on that and forget everything positive that you said, right? And so we've got a lot of mechanisms there. We've broken our organization down into, you know, lots and lots of teams or pods, you know, for lack of a better term, so that we can really create that close-knit feel, despite the fact that we're 130, 140 people today, you know, very different than what we were, you know, 6 years ago plus. But we want to create that small company environment as much as we possibly can, so that there's more comfort from when they are receiving that feedback, right? I mean, we've got all the tools in place. You know, we use various systems to provide that feedback, to make it more real time. Again, to provide the capability for employees to provide that feedback going up as well, right, to their managers. And so we're you know, doing all we can to you know, try to cultivate that feedback in both directions, so that when the time comes, you know, it's more of a conversation as to, you know, here's how we can improve. Here's how we can, you know, if you improve in one of these, you know, one of these two areas, then, you know, we can see additional growth for you in the company. And I think focusing on that, the potential versus just, you know, what's going wrong, I think is really helpful.
Yeah, absolutely. That's definitely an insightful perspective into a very complicated space such as performance evaluations and feedback.
Yeah, that's not an easy one by any means.
Yeah, absolutely. Last segment is kind of the quick question, quick answer type of thing, like with a lot of podcasts. What's your content diet looking like these days? What are your go-to sources for information?
You know, I really enjoy Business Insider, just for regular, you know, every morning reading, early in the morning, you know, drinking my coffee is the first thing I do, as opposed to just diving into email. And then just always have a book, on tab for, you know, just the daily, you know, at least 10 pages a day type of thing, to, you know, to just kind of have that mental break, you know, business focus and everything like that, but just have that mental break from everything else that's going on in the world.
So great setup for the next question. What's your go-to book? What do you always recommend to others, and why is that?
Why am I blanking on the name of the book? The Obstacle is the Way. And so I know it's one that's, you know, referred to a lot, but, you know, I really just go back to the concept of turning obstacles and turning issues into opportunity. And I think that book really boils it down in a really insightful way. Mm-hmm.
If you were to put a message onto a billboard, what would that be?
That's a great question. I would say that, you know, take a negative, kind of going back to the book, take a negative situation and find the positive.
Mm-hmm. Ram, I can't thank you enough for your time today. It was a very short and very insightful conversation. I personally learned quite a bit. What I love doing with a lot of the guests that we have on the Ivy podcast is do a follow-up recording in about a year where we revisit the conversation from a year ago and see if that everything we've discussed still makes sense, still applies, and just basically doing that. So I'm definitely looking forward to doing that with you.
Look forward to it. I can't wait.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.